I'm Vermont Edition producer Daniela Fierro, popping in to say we've edited this podcast a little for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lefrak. In the world of politics, we've hit a relatively quiet time of year. The holidays are around the corner, the new legislative session doesn't start for another couple weeks, and nationally, the presidential inauguration is still more than a month away. But behind the scenes, local lawmakers and administration officials are busy. Election Day in Vermont brought with it an unofficial mandate. Voters implored lawmakers to address long-standing issues of affordability in the Green Mountain State. The Vermont Department of Taxes projects a nearly 6% average increase in education property taxes next year, unless some major structural changes occur. Governor Phil Scott is the top local elected official tasked with making those changes. He was first elected Vermont's governor in 2016. He formerly served as lieutenant governor under Democrat Peter Shumlin, and prior to that, he served as state senator. Governor Scott, welcome back to the show.
Well, good morning or good afternoon at this point.
Yes, thanks for joining us. Governor Scott, let's kick things off with property taxes, shall we? The state's projecting education property tax bills are going to rise in the coming fiscal year by an average of 5.9%. Will your administration be submitting a plan for how to address that increase?
Well, of course, we're all going to have to enter into this discussion to make sure that we reduce the tax burden on Vermonters. I just want to level set this as well. Many people are focusing on property taxes, and that's where we need to focus right now, because that's where what people saw. They saw their bill and knew that that wasn't affordable for them anymore. But just to continue to spend as much as we're spending without taking care of some of the structural problems within the education system doesn't fix the problem at all. And if we just focus on property taxes and don't consider other taxes as well in the overall spending, then we're not going to provide the relief that Vermonters are asking for. You know, 8 years ago, when I came into office as governor, education spending was about $1.5 billion. And today, it's closer to $2.5 billion. It's $2.4 billion, the second highest in the nation in education spending per pupil. And I think we may have even eclipsed that that milestone as well. We may be number one in the nation at this point. So we have a lot of work to do, but I think voters sent a clear message. They want a more affordable Vermont, but it's not just about property taxes. Hmm.
Would you say that affordability is your number one priority for the upcoming legislative session, or is it something else?
I would say that has been one of our priorities since day one. I think most, Michaela, I'm sure you've heard it numerous times. Vermonters have certainly heard it. I've used it in every single speech I've given to the legislature starting 8 years ago when I talked about making Vermont more affordable, growing the economy, and protecting the most vulnerable are the pillars of our being. It's who what we need to do to provide relief to Vermonters and move us forward, not backwards. So, yes, affordability will be again one of the principles that we'll adhere to.
Well, while we're on this topic of affordability and its overlaps with Vermont's education funding system, I want to ask you about Zoe Saunders, who late last month you reappointed to serve as permanent education secretary. She's been serving as interim secretary since April 30th. The Vermont Senate voted down her confirmation last spring when you first appointed her, and it's been a point of contention between your administration and Democratic leaders for the past 9 months or so. I'm curious what you appreciate about Zoe Saunders' first 9 months in office that made you decide to reappoint her? And also if she's involved in these conversations about the spending on our education system that you keep highlighting.
Well, I think that I think legislators are I want to give them the benefit of the doubt. I think legislators are starting to get to know her and see what we see in her, breath of fresh air, a different perspective, works hard, incredibly bright and articulate, and will be part of how we provide education to high quality education for our students. While producing it at a cost we can afford. So I think we're seeing a bit of a softening with the legislature. They're seeing her attributes as well. I've heard comments by many who appreciate her perspective. So I believe this will, I thought it was political before. I'm going to give it the benefit of the doubt. Clean slate, and we'll begin again. But again, when you have the Democratic leader of the Education Committee, Senate Education, who was a proponent of Zoe Saunders, get up on the House floor, or the Senate floor, and talk about all her attributes then, and see that she got voted down, just told me that it was ripe with politics. And it's a new day, a new year, a new body, and I have great hopes that she'll be confirmed.
Let's go to the phones. We have Megan calling in from South Burlington. What's your question or your comment for Governor Phil Scott, Megan?
Yes, hi. Thank you, Michaela, and thank you, Governor Scott. It's really important for the people of Vermont to hear directly from their governor. I am calling from South Burlington, and like many towns and cities in our state, we are facing another challenging budget year for our public schools. And you have asserted numerous times that our education fund provides the only second, or I guess the top second, cost per pupil in the nation. And I know, having talked to both legislators as well as other people I know throughout our country, that our education fund also funds human and health services as well as facilities for our schools, which is not the case in every state throughout the nation. So I really want to challenge the apples to apples comparison, giving perhaps a false perception that our schools are overpriced, our public schools. And I'd like you to actually back up that assertion that we are the second highest cost per pupil in the nation, actually comparing apples to apples. Thank you.
Yeah, we'd be happy to do that, because I do believe that we are one of the highest in the nation. And to say that, we have our challenges.
And so just to jump in, I do think that a report from the Agency of Education that came out at the end of last month said that we were the highest cost per pupil per student.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Again, I think that we have to acknowledge that we have some mental health challenges, with some emotional issues, with some of our kids as a result of the pandemic, but that's been the case for many across the country. So I believe we are comparing apples to apples, but we'd be happy to produce the data to either back it up or walk it back, one of the two. But it doesn't change the fact that we were spending $1.5 billion 8 years ago, and we're spending $2.4 billion or more now. Those are facts you can't debate. So, regardless of how that is, we were doing the same thing then as we are now. So, again, I want to make sure that we're providing an education to our children that is the best in the nation, at a price we can afford.
Hmm. Well, thank you, Megan, for the call. Let's go next to Stephen in Stratford. Stephen, go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I want to say, Governor, why aren't we taxing second homes the way we should be, which is doubling their taxes? We pay income tax. We live in the state. You can't find a house because the prices are so high, because people are buying second homes and living in Vermont, I think that they're not paying enough tax.
Mm. Thank you, Stephen. Governor Scott, thoughts on increasing the property tax rates on second homes?
Well, I think the number of people I've spoke to, second homeowners in Vermont, and let's make sure that we know what we're talking about. It's not just out-of-staters who are paying these property taxes. When we talk about the non-residential portion of our taxes, that's businesses. That is second homeowners, camp owners, Vermonters who just want to enjoy themselves in the summer, deer camps and so forth, as well as those second homeowners from other states. They pay a lot now and don't receive the services that others enjoy, our education system being one. So we just have to be careful with that. And I just think that we can deliver education in a much more equitable way if we pay attention to that. But if we start increasing the tax on the non-residential side, that's going to impact businesses, and they're just going to pass those costs on to consumers, which is us. And so we're not really solving the problem by just spending more. We need to find ways to provide the education in a more equitable way, in a more cost-effective way than we're doing today. And I truly believe that can be accomplished.
Well, speaking of possible accomplishments or points of emphasis for this upcoming legislative session, Governor, the legislature is going to look a little bit different in terms of the split between parties than it did last session. On Election Day, Republicans gained 17 seats in the state House and 6 in the state Senate. Democrats, of course, still control both of those chambers, but they don't enjoy the supermajority that they did last session. You campaigned pretty hard for a number of Republicans that won their seats. What do you hope will be different about this legislative session?
Well, I think it will give us a seat at the table, and so that they will need to listen. The majority will still be the majority. They control the agenda, but at the same time, they will have to at least consider our proposals as they move forward. So I think it'll be a healthier debate, and will be more like what we've seen in the first 6 years. And it won't be as though there will still be controversy. We'll disagree vehemently in some areas, but at the same time, I think we'll come to a better conclusion, and everyone will have to give a little bit to get what they want.
You also backed the lieutenant governor-elect Republican John Rogers over the incumbent David Zuckerman, who's a progressive Democrat. The lieutenant governorship, I mean, you're a former lieutenant governor, so it's a bit of a funny position. In some ways, it's very prominent. In some ways, there's not a lot of direct day-to-day, you know, legislating, things like that, that a regular Vermonter might notice. Now that you are going to be working with John Rogers, and you both are, you know, very vocally supported one another's politics. Do you think there are ways in which Vermonters might notice a difference?
Well, I think, you know, it may not be what Vermonters will notice on a day-to-day basis, but the lieutenant governor, for instance, is a member of the Committee on Committees. And they appoint in the Senate, they appoint the members of the committees, committee chairs, and so forth. And while they don't have veto power, it's a three-member committee, they do have input. And I think that that's going to be important. For instance, last 2 years, there wasn't a single Republican, maybe, and a lot of that due to the numbers, but not a single Republican sat on natural resources. And I don't think that's healthy. I think there should be at least one from the minority party on every single committee. I don't think it should be stacked in any way. And it should be, those members should be equitably distributed throughout all the committees in the Senate, so that you can hear different perspectives. So I think that's one. Another, of course, is there's going to be some close votes now. It's going to be closer than before. So the lieutenant governor, as a presiding officer of the Senate, will have tie-breaking ability. So that might impact more visibly than the committee assignment. So again, having another friendly voice on your side that has a statewide platform will be helpful.
Let's take one more call here before we have to take a short break. Chris in Castleton, you're on the line. Go ahead.
How you doing, Governor?
I'm good.
Thank
you.
My name's Chris, and I just my question is every state I drive through to get out of Vermont, except I think New Hampshire, I get, you know, a toll. But everybody that comes into Vermont through the Fairhaven corridor going north, or, you know, on the 89 or the 91, you know, they don't pay tolls to come into Vermont. And I've done the numbers before. It's quite a bit of money. And I don't see why we can't throw up tolls easily enough today with our technology and computers.
All right. Tolls on Vermont's highways. Governor Scott, is this something you'd support?
Yeah, you know, that's been brought up many, many times over the last couple of decades. The issue, Chris, isn't whether we should or shouldn't. It's whether we can. With the federal government and the way the money flows, we receive a lot of federal money. We're dependent on federal money, especially for roads and bridges. So once you accept that money, you accept it under certain conditions. So if we get, let's say, 80, 90% funding from the federal government, it means that we cannot put tolls on those highways. So I would say that the secondary roads in particular can't do, but even 89, 91, 93, all of those are, we've accepted federal money. And without a change from the federal government, we're not able to do so. Now, it's not to say that they won't do something in the future, but that isn't the case today. And I'm not sure it's on their radar either in Congress. So again, I understand that's an easy place to go, but New Hampshire built those roads, those highways with their own money. They bonded for it and they used the tolls to pay that off. And that's why they can continue to toll. Same with New York. Not all their highways are able to do that, but they've taken advantage of the ones that they built themselves and paid for themselves.
Today on the show, we are joined by Governor Phil Scott. His fifth term as Vermont's governor begins next month. Also next month, Donald Trump will be inaugurated for his second term as president. Now, Governor Scott, you've made it very clear over the years that you are not a Trump supporter. You didn't vote for him in the last elections. Frederick in Brattleboro wrote us this email. Donald Trump largely ignored Vermont during his first presidency, but some of us suspect that he will attempt to shift resources to states that were more supportive of his goals and punish and make examples of those that didn't display sufficient fealty. As a Republican governor who didn't support the candidate, do you feel the president-elect may be planning to penalize you personally or our state in various ways?
Well, I certainly hope not, but we'll see what happens. I think there are bigger fish to fry. He's going to have a number of bigger states on his left who don't support him, that he probably and probably have their eyes on running for president in the next election, that will be more problematic for him. And I would think that would be like Illinois, maybe California, New York, there's a whole list. So we'll see. It doesn't change my perspective. I don't think you need to fall in line just because somebody threatens you. And he hasn't threatened, I want to be clear about that, he hasn't threatened us in any way. We actually had a pretty good relationship with the White House itself. Some of the folks from the last administration when he was in office, And we were able to work together, at least behind the scenes and so forth. So look forward to doing whatever we can to improve the lives of Vermonters and make sure that we're getting our fair share and we're being heard. And we'll give them the benefit of the doubt. And this is a new administration. He put together his cabinet. And we'll do the best we can with what the cards that were dealt.
Yeah, speaking of that cabinet, over the past couple of weeks, we've noticed that the Republican Governors Association has been putting out this series of press releases supporting the agenda of President-elect Trump. Just today, they sent one in support of South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem, who's been nominated to serve as the next Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. There were 22 signatories out of the 27 Republican governors on that email. Your name is noticeably absent from the list, as it has been on other similar emails. Why?
Well, I don't know about that one in particular. They, you know, I'm very careful about what I sign my name to. I want to believe in it wholeheartedly. There must have been something that, you know, gave us pause or gave me pause, but I don't recall what that was. And sometimes they're very quick. There's a quick turnaround time. And they need it within, you know, 12 hours or something. And that's just not doable from my standpoint. So not without doing some research to make sure that we know what we're getting ourselves into.
Well, let's go back to the phone lines. Looks like we have a couple questions coming in around property taxes, education spending, and the like. We'll start with Mac in Callis. Mac, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Yes, I just wanted to challenge the governor about equity in education. I hear a lot of talk about the equity in education, yet, you know, kids that are receiving special education are one of the worst, you know, have some of the worst outcomes in the nation. And so I haven't heard anyone articulate why, what's the problem with, you know, why do we have such a huge equity problem? And then what is, you know, how are they going to fix that problem? Mm. And I wonder if the governor could do, you know, he says he thinks he can do this. Well, if he thinks he can do this, what is the problem with equity and what is the solution? Thank you.
Governor?
Well, I guess I'm not quite sure what the caller is getting at.
Do you mind if I clarify with the caller there for a second? Mac, when you say equity in education, are you talking about different schools and school districts getting different amounts of resources per student or type of equity?
I'm talking about equity between different groups of children and families. If they have free and reduced lunch, their outcomes are much worse. And if they're on special education, like I said, we have some of the worst outcomes in the nation for students of that population. And so, you know, how do we improve that equity? You know, why are our students doing so poorly? And, you know, what is the solution to that problem?
Okay, so improving outcomes for kids who are on free and reduced lunch or who have other high needs.
Well, again, I think the system itself, when you look at the number of students that we once educated, it was to the tune of almost 125,000 at one time. I don't know what the exact number is, 125,000 students, now down to like 80 to 85. And we have the same system, same structure. So we are educating fewer kids with the same system. So a lot of it is getting eaten up. The costs are within the system itself. So we have too many teachers and so forth, the system itself, for a smaller number of kids. So we have to right size that in some way. And it doesn't mean closing every school that doesn't have enough students. It just means that we have to downsize in a way and create a structure that makes it equitable within the community. So there's going to be some tough decisions to be made over the next couple of years. And that's going to be the difficult part. We just need to find ways to make sure that kids are getting the education they deserve, but it isn't getting used up by the system itself.
Thank you, Mac, for your call. Let's go next to Wendy in Middlesex. Wendy, go ahead.
Yeah, Governor Scott, I have a 21-year-old and a 24-year-old who went to Rumney School in Middlesex, and I used to go to the school board meetings quite frequently. The issue of how expensive our health care is for the teachers and the paras and everyone that works in the school has exacerbated, and I don't hear that much conversation when we're talking about cutting back and making school and property taxes affordable, addressing the issue that health insurance for our teachers that work so hard is such a huge part of this issue.
Thank you, Wendy. Yeah, I'm curious to hear that as well, the role that rising health care costs plays in many of these areas that we're talking about, Governor. How much of that is in the state's control?
Yeah, it definitely is a major factor as well. I mean, the healthcare costs, education costs, some of the problems associated with that are similar. And if you really dig deep, it's the same issue. It's demographics. You look at the latest census, and I talk about this a lot. We may have gained 21,000 people according to the latest census, but we lost 14,000 of our youth, you know, ages 0 to 17, have 14,000 fewer under the age of 18. We've lost 20,000 people between the ages of 40 to 54. That's our workforce. That's the backbone of our workforce. And then we gained 48,000 more people over the age of 65, the baby boomers, myself included. I mean, we're aging out, but we're not replacing that with a healthier working population. And that's what the problem is. And making it more unaffordable in Vermont isn't going to bring more people into the state. So that's why demographics is key to whatever we do. And that's why housing is so important. If we don't have the housing, we're not going to grow the workforce that we desperately need. We need more people in Vermont, more working age people in Vermont to work our way out of this because we need more taxpayers, not more taxes.
On that subject of housing, a number of people emailed us ahead of today's show about homelessness in Vermont. Governor, I'm curious to hear from your perspective how the state-run Williston and Waterbury shelter operations are going. And do you think our state needs more state-run shelters like this moving forward? Is that the path you think we should take?
Yeah, I do. I think that the hotel motel program was a failure. It didn't do anything but house people. It didn't help them lift them out of homelessness. It just, you know, put them in a warehouse, them in a hotel. So I think that what we've come up with here, and we need to improve what we have. But for instance, with the family shelters we have in Williston and Waterbury, I think it's going to be helpful because we have more eyes on them. We're able to identify their needs. Why are they homeless? What can we do to help them out of this? Is it job related? Is it addiction related? And we need to do everything we can to provide that safety net around them to help lift them out of poverty, out of homelessness. So I think that that part has been successful. And I think that we need to do more, not just with family shelters, but emergency shelters, congregate shelters overall. I think that's the answer more than a hotel motel program where we don't see them again. Mm-hmm. Once we put them in the warehouse, them in a motel or a hotel, then we don't have eyes on them at all.
Mm. Well, as I said, we got emails from folks all across the state about this issue. Seth in South Burlington, Rebecca in Brattleboro. And I also wanted to ask you about something that happened close to your own home there in Berlin. Just a couple weeks ago, a person died at an encampment there, and that happened. happened just a few days after a couple died in a tent they were staying in Wolcott. How did this news hit you, especially since one of the deaths happened in your town?
Yeah, obviously concerning. Any death is tragic. And we're still waiting for the investigation to come to completion to find out what happened. The two in Wolcott, I think you probably reported on this. I'm sure you have, because there was the sister of one of those who unfortunately lost their life. Was there staying at her home in her backyard with a extension cord, with electricity, with a heater offered and used the shower, laundry, and so forth at the house, and was offered a better arrangement and chose not to do that. So we're waiting for that to unfold. The other one in Berlin, same situation. They were in contact. They were in an emergency shelter or a homeless shelter of some sort, but chose to not stay there any longer. So again, we're waiting to hear the results of the investigation, but tragic, and it's unfortunate, and we need to do as much as we can. But we had some of those tragedies as well with the hotel motel program. We had numerous deaths in our hotels and motels over the years, and they just weren't reported. Yeah.
Let's go to one more caller here. David in Shrewsbury is on the line. David, go ahead.
Yes, Governor Scott, thank you for taking my call. I did vote for you and Lieutenant Governor Roberts, and I think you've done a fantastic job as governor of our state, really giving us a lot to be proud of. Now, you mentioned before about the homeless situation. Y'all were talking about giving people aid and so forth, the hotel situation. I live in Rutland County, so we've seen a lot of that in Rutland City. And the thing is, when I saw it, it really bothered me because I never really saw an end game being put in place when it came to career counseling or the housing shortage and making sure people some place to go once the hotel situation ended. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, I would think the hotel situation is there to help people end what they're going and lead them to a better life and maybe make them those productive taxpayers you were speaking about earlier, Governor. Can you tell me how you're going to, especially now that the legislature is a little more even, will it be easier? Or do you have a plan in place to kind of push those agendas maybe to help solve those end game problems of housing people?
Thanks, David.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, our housing crisis is amongst our number one priorities. And that, again, is due to decades of not building enough housing to keep up. So producing more housing will help those who are homeless. And I think that we'll produce more of our workforce that we desperately need, and reduce if there's more supply and the demand goes down. Hopefully the price comes down with it. So that's all beneficial as well. So again, for those who are truly homeless, as I said before, we want to provide those wraparound services. And if we have a emergency shelter, for instance, we're trying to open one up in Rutland, where a congregate type of shelter, where we are interacting with them, those who are homeless on a daily basis, in providing services and finding them a job and getting them back on their feet and getting them clean, whatever we need to do, that's going to be much more beneficial than throwing them in a hotel motel and saying, good luck, we'll see you at the end of the program, probably out on the street again.
Well, thank you to everyone who submitted questions for Governor Phil Scott and participated in this conversation today. Governor, I want to make sure we end on a piece of exciting, positive news here in Vermont that probably interests you as a UVM grad. The UVM men's soccer team is on a historic run. They're going to be playing in their first ever NCAA men's soccer championship game tonight at 8. Any words of encouragement for the team? Will you be watching?
Yeah, I'll be definitely watching. I'm a UVM grad myself, very proud of the team and what they've accomplished so far. And for a small state like Vermont to be on the national stage and on the edge of possibly winning a national championship is truly remarkable. So we'll be watching tonight and hope for the best. I know that they're a great team and just exude confidence. So. We look forward to seeing the game tonight.
Governor Phil Scott, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
If you're just joining us, we just had a conversation with Governor Phil Scott about his upcoming fifth term and the new legislative session that begins next month in Montpelier. Joining us now from the capital city is Bob Kinzel, Vermont Public's senior reporter. He's been covering the State House since 1981. Hey, Bob.
Hey, Michaela.
So what stood out to you from that conversation? There's a couple of things I want to ask you about, but I'm going to let you start.
Well, certainly the governor talking about education, and nothing really new there that he's talking about. You've got to address education spending, that is more important than how you pay for it. We're paying for it with property taxes now. There's some people who would like to transfer it over more to the income tax. And I think the governor is arguing, hey, it doesn't matter which tax source you pick. If you don't get spending under control, you're going to go bankrupt. And the other thing was, you know, with the change in the legislature and the Democrats not having super majorities anymore, although they still have good majorities. And he said, OK, now the Republicans have a seat at the table.
Yeah.
And the Democrats need to listen to the Republican proposals. Well, that's absolutely true. And I would add to that, that the Republicans even have a little more responsibility now to be at the table and offer proposals themselves that are quite concrete. Just saying that the Democratic plan isn't good enough isn't going to work. So they've got to be partners in this, and it'll be fascinating to see how this unfolds during the legislative session.
Mm. Oh, Bob, I know you have a particular interest over there in health care, and I'm curious what you thought of Governor Scott's response to a listener's point about the role that rising health care costs play, not just in our school budgets, but in affordability overall in the state.
Absolutely. Healthcare, we hear a lot about property taxes, right, from the election results. Healthcare costs are soaring in Vermont. Most businesses are paying an additional 20-25% a year in premiums. And of course, that means that the employees are paying it as well. This is a huge issue. And I think really at the heart of all this, Michaela, is the fact that demographics is at the center of almost every issue that we're going to be talking about in this session. And the trend that I think really highlights this, and every time I see this trend, it just blows my mind, is that between 2020 and 2030, our general population in Vermont is going to go up about 1.5 or 2%, pretty stable. The population of Vermonters during that decade, 2020 to 2030, over 65, is going to increase 50%. Now, think about what that does to the healthcare system. Older people have more healthcare issues. It affects housing. It affects property taxes. It affects the workforce. We're seeing a battle playing out now between the Green Mountain Care Board and the UVM Medical Center of Vermont in terms of what are appropriate budgets. And if those budgets can't be met, then they're going to be program cuts. And so I think healthcare is going to be at the center of a lot of activity during the session. But the bottom line, I really think, is there's not a lot the state can do.
Yeah.
You know, this is a federal issue as well. And there are places where I'm sure some of the healthcare leaders at the State House are saying, well, we could address this and we could address that. But, you know, is there a big master plan that they could put into place to make healthcare costs more stable? I'm not sure that exists.
Yeah. Speaking of that national level of issues, Bob, we got a number of emails ahead of today's show with concerns about, you know, what's going to happen to Vermont when Donald Trump becomes president again. And it seems like there's this concern about some folks here about some sort of retribution happening. You know, Vermont being traditionally a very liberal, very progressive place, you know, our delegates to the Republican National Convention this year were seated way, way, way in the back row. And they're worried, is that going to, you know, does this portend our future under the next Trump administration? Do you think there is any truth to those concerns? Governor Scott doesn't seem concerned.
He didn't seem concerned. He seemed to think that President-elect Trump would have bigger fish to fry than those in Vermont. But at the same time, I'm not sure it falls under the retribution category, but it could be falling under what kind of impact could the new administration have? And, you know, there are things like tariffs. You know, if 25% tariffs are imposed, what does that do to Vermont's trade with Canada? What does that do to a lot of businesses in Vermont? What happens if Congress, with the recommendation of the president-elect, does not renew the subsidies for the Affordable Care Act? That would have a huge impact. We're just talking about health care. How many people in Vermont are able to get subsidies through the Affordable Care Act? Would the president-elect and the administration and the new Congress decide to really scale that back? So I think there are areas that we can see where maybe not retribution, but on policy changes could have a big impact on Vermonters.
Hmm. Well, to return to issues managed at the local level, Bob, one thing that stood out to me from my conversation I had just now with Governor Scott was his wording when discussing the emergency motel housing program here in Vermont. He was pretty blunt. He called it a failure. What do you think we could see from the legislature, from the governor's administration, when it comes to addressing homelessness in this new session?
I got the impression from the governor, not only today, but previously, that one of the reasons he thinks the hotel motel program has not been a success is that there isn't a clear link between some of the state's social services that are available and the folks taking qualifying for those programs. And that's what he wants. He wants to have an opportunity for folks to see what different state programs are available. How can we change and improve their lives? And I think we're going to see the legislature addressing that as well.
Mm. Now, a number of longtime lawmakers retired or passed away at the end of last session. It leaves some open seats on some pretty important committees. When are we going to start to see all those committee assignments shaking out, things falling into place?
I would expect to see it on the first or second day of the session, in that middle of January, was it January 8th or 9th? I think this legislature has a sense that they want to hit the ground running. And one way to do that is to say, okay, we're acknowledging we want to really focus on property taxes for the first month of the session and have almost every committee in the Senate and the House address it in some way. And to do that, they need to have everybody on board right away. So I think that's going to be a very quick decision. You know, the Committee on Committees is probably talking about it right now in the Senate, and I'm sure in the House, Speaker Jill Kerwinski, who does face a challenge for the speakership, is also looking at different people who could head up different committees. So I think they're going to make those decisions really, really quickly.
Mm. And as the governor noted, our new Lieutenant Governor John Rogers sits on that important committee now, right?
That's right. And so, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how John Rogers fits into things. Will he be a part of the Scott administration cabinet as sort of a ex officio member? What issues does John Rogers really want to focus on? Now, he talked a lot about affordability during his campaign, so I expect him to get quite involved in the property tax question, in things like housing, workforce training, I think he's going to be an active lieutenant governor, understanding that it's really sort of an undefined role, and it is what he makes it to be. But I think he wants to make it something.
Well, Bob, let's look to the future here for just a moment. Return to this national stage with the inauguration. You're always in close contact with Vermont's delegation to Congress. Anything that you're keeping an eye on right now? Any points of interest as we from the Capitol as we look to this new era?
I think it's going to be really interesting to see how these cabinet appointments fare in the Senate committee hearings. Both Senator Welch and Senator Sanders have expressed concerns about some of President-elect Trump's nominees. For instance, at the FBI, Kash Patel. How will those hearings unfold? What role will Senator Sanders and Senator Welch play in those hearings? That's something I'm going to really be keeping an eye on for the first couple of weeks of the new congressional session.
Bob, I feel like they should really make some sort of like baseball card style game for us nerds who follow both national and local politics at this close a level. We could do like trading cards, that kind of thing. What do you think?
I'd love to see you do it.
It's my new business idea. All right, Bob, we just have about a minute left. Anything else you want to draw out for us from Governor Phil Scott's conversation here on Vermont Edition, or things you're keeping an eye on for the future of Vermont politics 2025?
Well, I would say don't expect any grand proposals to come out of the Scott administration on education spending or health care, because I think they want to collaborate with members of the legislature. And the way to do that is to get together, to talk, to listen. Let's try this. What do you think about that? And so it's not going to be coming in and saying, here's Governor Scott's 10-point plan to save education in Vermont. I don't think that's going to happen.
Bob Kinzel in Montpelier, thank you so much for joining us and providing this context to the conversation.
My pleasure.